from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, best-selling author Amy Tan's latest novel was partly inspired by a photo of her grandmother, and after looking through old pictures of Chinese courtesans, she was struck by the fact that their clothes were similar to those worn by her grandmother. The story behind her grandmother's clothing remains a mystery, but the photo led to her latest novel, The Valley of Amazement. And in it, Amy Tan uncovers the hidden lives of high-class courtesans in 20th century Shanghai. She'll join us in studio for the hour ahead, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Bay Area-based author Amy Tan joins us in studio for this second Forum hour, the author of The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, The Bonesetter's Daughter, Saving Fish from Drowning, and many other books. She recently published her first novel in 8 years, The Valley of Amazement, about a white American woman named Lulu Mentorn, who becomes a courtesan and the proprietor of a courtesan house in Shanghai's International Settlement, and her daughter Violet, who also becomes a courtesan. And Amy Tan, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
And I should mention that Amy has brought a whole strew of photographs with her. you've been talking a lot about how your grandmother inspired this, or seeing a photograph of your grandmother, and I'm looking at them. Unfortunately, this is radio, so nobody can see them. But describe for us, if you would, these visual aids that you've brought in here.
One is a photo of my grandmother, my favorite. It's taken around 1910. She has on a headband that forms a V at the top of her forehead. It has pearls and embroidery in it. She has a tight jacket on with a collar that goes just below her earlobe. And she has sleeves that are tight and shorter than normal, and has white lining to the wrists, matching bracelets, tight pants, and taken in a Western photo studio with pots of flowers around it. I learned that through another photo, five women dressed identically, that these were the elements of a courtesan.
And that was the inspiration for this novel, which took you away from a novel that you had been writing. You've actually said that your grandmother has been your muse. I always thought Daisy, your mother, was your major muse, but this is your grandmother.
My grandmother was my muse in part since the beginning of the writing. And my mother was there as my truth detector and my opposite of truth detector. And now, you know, my mother has passed, so they're both in collusion, helping me to write things and giving me information, gifts and things. And also, yeah.
You talked about this. I mean, the fact that you kind of act as a medium sometimes, or think you do, perhaps.
I don't intentionally go off trying to be a medium, but things happen. You know, things come to me and I have to wonder where this comes from. It's hard to explain it simply as coincidence.
Well, I got a little preview of this book when we did an appearance together and you read from 50 Shades of Tan, an essay about writing about all the sexuality. This is a whole different Amy Tan, by the way, sort of the Kama Sutra Chinese version of Amy Tan that you'll meet in Valley of Amazement. I wonder, were you a little squeamish thinking about your grandmother and your mother looking over your shoulder, writing all this boudoir
stuff?
Incredibly so.
You know, my grandmother has brought me all these gifts over the years, you know, and then I thought, boy, what if she doesn't like what I'm writing? You know, making aspersions on her, casting aspersions on her character. You know, she's going to blow up my disk drive. And so I had a lot of trepidation. But after a while, when I was writing the story, the characters are nothing like my grandmother or my mother. And I wholly was into their world and who they were, not my grandmother and my mother. It had simply to do with the situation and trying to imagine a world that they might have lived in, that my grandmother might have lived in.
This is also a prodigiously researched book. Probably more research went into this book than any book you've written.
I think it was because I was so obsessed with needing to know the history of this time period that affected my family so much. It turned out, for example, that both sides of my family were in foreign trade. And this was a period of intense foreign trade, the explosion of Shanghai, the growth of Shanghai to a million people by the turn of the century.
Is it rough writing about sex? I remember one of my mentors said it was very difficult because, you know, you have to somehow be original, and there's just so much you can be original about.
Yeah. Well, I was afraid of writing corny love scenes, and I told my editor, you have to save me from doing that. And also I had to write about things that had more to do with the negotiation of sex, and it was not romantic sex. I was afraid also that people might read this and think, as they have with all my books, that I have just written thinly disguised memoir, that this was taken from my own experiences.
Well, set in a different time and a different place, and hardly, I suppose, able, a thoughtful reader to make that jump. But there is something of an intimacy that you get into in this book. I mean, a physical intimacy, obviously, but also beyond that, just the courtesan's charms and the way the courtesan would work. I mean, it's a commerce type of work.
Yeah, and I think it's also the psychological approach that we would use with their clients, with their these men, these high, highly positioned men in politics and business, and what they needed to do. And I had this notion that they would appeal to their ideal selves. You know, men, I think, are very romantic about their own sense of self and what they're going to accomplish in their lives, and especially a Chinese man who is leading, has to honor both the ancestral history of the family and carry forward. And so they would be the ones who would cater that and let them, you know, believe that they had fulfilled all of that.
It's, again, the idea of male ego, really, isn't it? And being able to at least appeal to a male ego?
Yes, and in part what Magic Gourd, Violet's mentor, says is their nostalgia, that all men have an area of weakness, their nostalgia. And if you can touch that, he is yours.
Let's talk about her mentor. One of the more fascinating characters, Magic Gourd. I mean, some of the names in this book almost, well, some of them certainly go back to the whole idea of courtesans having their own names and so forth. But even non-courtesan figures like Fairweather, you know, I thought it was in a Dickens novel, giving a character that name and so forth. But you you give this woman a kind of wisdom, really, that someone who has been in this business, as it were, for many years would come by.
Right. And she's fallen in love many times and thought that she had found true love. And she's been through the hardships, all the hardships you can possibly have, including facing going down in stature and having to settle into a second-class house or the streets or whatever. She has also been very pragmatic about her life. Her name, in fact, changed to Magic Gourd, which stands for the Chinese characters, all that you wish. And it's homophonous with Magic Gourd.
How is your Chinese, by the way? Now?
Not good. No. I can talk gossip with my sister. We not talk about food. She can tell me that I've gotten either gained more weight or lost more weight and things like that. But we'll talk for 4 days straight, only in Chinese.
Well, this you talk about your sister. This is another book about mothers and daughters. And certainly those who are familiar readers of Amy Tan know that that's been an area that she has explored through a great majority of her works. And yet there's a kind of a, I'm not, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but there's a repeat in generations of something that occurs, particularly with mothers and daughters.
Yeah.
And I think what you're trying to work with here is generations. And so you did something that you normally don't do. You kind of split off into nonlinear time.
Yes. I wanted to begin the story with Violet. She's the main narrator, and her life is affected by her mother, and she has all these questions about who her mother was, and by knowing that, did her mother truly love her? And later in the book, we hear from Lulu, her mother, and find out about her background and things that happened that made her also feel similarly to what Violet feels. Those characteristics were also ones that I've questioned and that my half-sisters have questioned. And it had to do with my mother and her vanity and a certain degree of selfishness that she exhibited, especially when she left the United States to be with her lover, who was my father, and left behind.
Baptist preacher lover.
Yeah, well, he became a Baptist preacher when he felt very guilty for having fallen in love with a married woman. But at the same time, she left behind three of her daughters in Shanghai.
Who you met later on in life.
Yes, and we're very close now.
This is an epic, really, isn't it, this novel?
An epic life. My mother had an epic
life. And a novel.
My mother had an epic life. Yes, it depends on what you call epic, but it has a lot of the generational tragedies and inheritance of unknown histories.
So when you were doing this research and you found, I mean, how much of this houses of flowers and hidden jade path and moon plot, I mean, how much of this is fictional and how much of it goes to the root of things you discovered in research?
What is true is that the first-class courtesan houses were located in the international settlement in Shanghai, and that's where our family had homes. The Moon Pond Village setting was based on my having gone to the most remote, poorest province in China and climbing up to a mountain and living there, and also taking those pathways high into the mountains and sometimes feeling that if I lost my footing, I was going to fall over and be killed. So that actual visceral sense of, you know, peril came from research, so to speak. Living in a house that was 400 years old, that was very drafty and slipping on the moss, that was, you know, what I had to do for the book.
For your art.
Yes, for my art. I didn't count on falling on moss twice, but...
Talking with Amy Tan, her new book is out and available. It's The Valley of Amazement. Her other novels include The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife, and she'll be appearing at City Arts and Lectures tonight at 7:30. So much of your work, I mean, it's fiction. You're a really wonderful storyteller. Your imagination takes over, and yet I always have the feeling, I mean, as someone who's read you through the years and knowing you through the years, that you're looking for your own identity, for keys to your own identity.
That's really what all my books have been about. People say, oh, mother-daughter story. That's one component. It's a huge one. You know, mothers being very influential in very large ways, especially when we look at those characteristics we have that we try to shun, that we try to avoid and find in our middle years and later that we have and can't get rid of, these obsessions or these habits. But
or
also
these
self-identity.
In your head, right?
Yeah, also self-identity, because I've had to look at myself both, you know, biculturally, being raised in this country and then having a mother, not knowing that history and finding that I've been very much influenced by it.
Also, there's... I was thinking about the fact that so many people identify you with your dogs and know the story about your dogs. But there's a cat in this novel, although you did a kid's book about a cat, too. But this is a very distinct cat.
This is, this golden cat. And it's based on an actual breed. But it reminded me of I was taking the heart of my cat, Sagwa, who became the cartoon series. And she was a fairly vicious cat who would send people to the hospital. Those who said, oh, no, cats love me, you know, after I had warned them, do not touch this cat. And that's the cat that's in this book.
And Tina reminds me that there may be people who don't know about you and dogs.
My dogs. I'm usually have my dogs here on
you expected to see them.
Yeah, but I have a new one. He's not quite ready for Michael Krasny primetime.
I should also mention that Amy will appear at places with the dogs very much in tow, even in places where
am I
outing you here? Yeah. Don't aren't necessarily all that amenable to the idea of dogs. The dogs go with you everywhere, really.
Yeah, and you know,
I'm surprised they're not here.
Well, you know, the first ones were very well trained, and they were absolutely quiet, unless they started snoring. And then people thought there were stomach eructations or something. We'd have to explain that they were present.
How important is it? I mean, storyteller is what you are, and writer of fiction, novelist, etc. But to tell a story about strong women and women who are resilient and women who really are admirable in many ways for their resiliency.
I was really excited with this book when I discovered more information about my grandmother that dispelled the myth that she was quiet and submissive, old-fashioned and traditional. She became much more real to me when I looked at these photos and I talked to family, and I learned she had a very violent temper, as a matter of fact, and that she had very strong opinions, and that one woman who was in her late 80s, who lived on the island where my grandmother lived and died, she said that she had such strong opinions that if you disagreed with her, if you did not listen to her, you would be sorry later. And that echoed in my mind as something that my mother did. Yeah, you couldn't disagree with her on her opinion. We're not talking about betraying her in some big way. She would threaten suicide. And I felt that I was seeing my grandmother now through this different lens. Now, one thing that I also very much appreciated and I think came from my grandmother is my mother's insistence that I be independent in all ways. She said, you must have your own job so that at any moment, if you marry, not when, but if you marry, you could leave your husband at any time without question, without wondering how you were going to do that.
This was going to be as a concert pianist?
Yes. Well, you know, that for my pastime when I didn't have a husband to entertain me, but to be a brain surgeon. She also said that I shouldn't let anybody's opinion determine how I thought of myself, except for hers, of course. And she said that if I didn't want to have a baby, no one should tell me that I must have a baby, not my husband or mother-in-law, anybody. And she was very modern for her time. And I think she got a lot of that from her mother.
A lot of this is autonomy, independence, but there's an obstinacy, too, you're talking about, too, especially when your mother says, you can't even disagree with my opinion.
Yeah, you know, how can you think that? I haven't put that in your mind yet.
You think that there was, from your research and from what you've imagined in this book, that courtesans, even though they were supposed to act passive and submissive and, you know, be pleasing the man all the time, that they could develop this sense of independence and autonomy?
Well, the passiveness or the pleasing, I think, was part of the act. But they were known to be one of the most, or the most independent of all classes of women, including wives. That's what I heard from a docent when I was at the Asian Art Museum, and I saw these illustrations of courtesans. They were the most influential in bringing popular Western culture into Shanghai and making it a fad. They created Western details for their clothing, and I saw that in some of the photographs of my grandmother.
This is a Shanghai exhibit that was there?
Number of years ago.
Yeah.
And they also had Western furniture in the first-class courtesan houses. They were quite lavish. Velvet curtains, things that were not part of a Chinese house. Fainting couches, you know, spittoons and billiard
bidets.
Tables. Bidets. I didn't see that, but I imagine that that was part of it, yes.
Talking to Amy Tan, whose new book is The Valley of Amazement, which comes from a painting, actually.
Yes. I saw the painting the first time I saw something like that was in Germany at the National Gallery. It was called The Valley of Amazement, and it was a title that I loved. And unfortunately, when I saw it, I didn't note who the artist was. But it was a valley, and you couldn't tell whether it was dawn or dusk. There were mountains on the side. There was a storm that was either brewing or leaving. There was a light at the end of the valley. And I couldn't tell whether it was that you were approaching this with dread or despair, whether you were leaving with relief. And that ambiguity is what really intrigued me. And it wasn't until later I thought this was the perfect image of what this book was about, that we reach crossroads in our lives often, and we don't know what we're looking at ahead, whether it is good or bad, and how to assess it, what our perspective is. And I then saw later on a painting similar to that by Albert Bierstadt, who was a painter of the Hudson River Valley School around the 1880s. And so it was a similar time period, a similar look, storm brewing, but this one somehow a little bit more positive.
It's amazing how things like that will creep into your work. I was thinking, had you read or were you in the process of reading Leaves of Grass when you wrote this novel?
I came across that. It was it was one of those serendipitous moments where I was writing this one chapter and trying to think what I really was trying to get to. And suddenly I came across this passage that that had so much to do with what was going on. Not I nor anyone can take that path with you, that road with you. You must go yourself. And I thought, this is really the feeling I've always had in my life, that you think somebody's going to be with you and help you, but no. And then somehow you've always known it. You know, that all of this has been there, and you've always been going along that path by yourself anyway. I also came across a poem that just struck me as, you know, exactly what my life seemed like, this one, Quicksand Years by Walt Whitman. And it had to do with all the everything that went on, you know, the politics and, you know, the times that were good and bad. And what is left at the end, what has always been there is one, the purity of oneself. And that was what endured, what was lasting. It wasn't all good necessarily, but it was a knowledge of who you are. And that knowledge is what I get through writing. You know, you have to work it out. There's no single way you could say, well, I'm independent or I'm strong or I'm this or I'm that. It is worked out in a story.
It's also worked out in reading. In fact, I think I remember you once saying that you would like to have Emily Dickinson as a housemaid or, you know, something along those lines, speaking about American poets, that you had such great admiration for her.
Well, somebody asked me, you know, what dead writer would you like to resurrect and have as your dinner companion? And I chose Emily Dickinson because I thought everything, she was so prolific and she could look at life even in the cloistered confines of her room and find such wisdom in everything about expectations in life and what is before you and expressed in what seems very simple and yet is so layered and has to do with so many dimensions of human nature and nature.
Do you, by any chance, have any aphrodisiacs that you could recommend from the sort of research that you did?
Yeah. Besides the usual things like tea, the ones that I found in the research included quite interesting names. One, first of all, you must know that some of the euphemisms for the female included the pavilion and the gates and things like that. And so there's one called Happiness in the Pavilion, and that was one for men, for their bold night. And the other for women, I imagine it was for women, it was called Gates Wide Open.
Pearly Gates, no doubt.
Pearly Gates of Wide Open.
Yes. Talking to Amy Tan, her new book, The Valley of Amazement. Let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. If you want to talk about Curtisons, about her new novel, or about other work of hers, this is an excellent opportunity to speak with one of the Bay Area's leading writers, and our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or a number of other ways that you can join this conversation with questions or comments. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and Amy will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera on Saturday, December 7th at 7 o'clock. She'll be part of City Arts and Lectures tonight. Roy Eisenhart will be interviewing her on stage at 7:30 p.m., and an opportunity for you to speak with her, and particularly be interested in some of you listeners of Chinese descent who may have your own interest in doing some digging around archaeologically in terms of your ancestry. And what you have found or what you might find might not necessarily lead to a novel, but it can certainly lead to a good deal of enlightenment. When we return, we'll bring you into the conversation. And again, Amy Tan's latest novel, partly inspired by a photo of her grandmother. And after looking through old pictures of Chinese courtesans, she was struck by the fact that their clothes were similar to those. And I'm advised again of the fact that they're right here in front of me in the studio. Her dogs aren't, but the photos are. These were worn by her grandmother. This is the story behind her grandmother's clothing, still a mystery, but led to the latest novel. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Amy Tan with us in studio, author of a new novel, The Valley of Amazement, her first novel in 8 years. And I was thinking back about the last time you were on with us. It wasn't with a novel. It was with this young singer that you were helping to promote. He was in Paris, and you heard him in Paris, and you kind of fell in love with his voice, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened to him?
Well, he's back in Paris, and he's still singing there, but trying to mount up a way to come back and sing in the States. You know, it takes a special permit to be able to do that for many venues. So,
and you know, I just happened to have lunch with a mutual friend of ours yesterday who was saying, you know, Amy is a very – she happened to be with you in Miami with the Rock Bottom Remainders. She said, Amy is an entirely different person. She has an entirely different identity when she's with the Rock Bottom Remainders. True?
I'm in costume and I'm allowed to do all kinds of things I would never do in public. You know, part of it is what is my public persona and what is my private one. And I think there is a little bit of me that comes out in those costumes.
And who are the Rock Bottom Remainders? Tina, thank you for asking that question. I just assume people have this kind of knowledge, and there are new listeners, there are listeners all the time who, heaven forfend, don't know who the Rock Bottom Remainders are. But there are a bunch of authors who have gone together for mostly charitable purposes, playing rock and roll music or with passes for rock and roll music, and have many famous names that you would recognize. And Amy is sort of the woman dressed in black, often a dominatrix, beating up on Stephen King, doing other things that are part of. Say a word about Kathy Goldmark, by the way, who we both loved.
Yeah, yeah. She founded the Rock Bottom. She founded the band 20 years ago, and she invited her favorite authors and Stephen King, Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Greg Iles, Mitch Albom, and Scott Turow, numerous people, and James McBride, who just won the National Book Award.
Yes, indeed. I saw that.
We are very proud of him. But she founded the band and brought together these disparate people. She was so inclusive of everybody. She was such a big heart, and she was one of my closest friends. And she sadly died, a year and a half ago. Broke our hearts, broke so many people's hearts.
It was extraordinary, in fact, when there was a memorial for Kathy, and it's like everybody in town.
Yeah,
and
they all had a story. They all had a story about what she did for them.
Yeah, no, she was a good friend of both of ours, and we both loved her and miss her. We can bring you into this conversation, by the way. You should feel free to join us. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. Maybe even hear from some people who have heard the Rock Bottom Remainders who might want to talk about them. But we're talking with Amy Tan about her new novel and about her work, and we're going to try to get these photographs that I've alluded to up on our website, get them from her website. And you can find them, actually, on Amy Tan's website, which you can get through a link to KQED's website, kqed.org. Let me bring a caller on here. And again, we welcome your calls and emails. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or our website is kqed.org/forum. And you can click on this segment and join us that way as well. Here's Neil. Neil, welcome.
Yes, I'd like to know, what is the best novel about China that you know of that's written by a Caucasian?
Oh.
And don't say The Good Earth, please.
By a Caucasian. That you put me on the spot. I'm trying to think mostly what I can think of are nonfiction ones. I just picked up a recent one called Midnight in Peking.
Orville Schell's new book is pretty good, too.
Orville Schell is a great writer about of China. And what is... Name some ones, Michael. Name some novels that have come out.
Was The Sand Pebbles any good?
I haven't read The Sand
Pebbles. No, I've not read it either. I have to cogitate on that a bit, Neil.
Yeah, yeah.
But thank you. But it prompts me to ask you about Chinese writers. And I've recently read a lot of Ha Jin, who I'm very impressed with.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Another writer I know you like is Yi Yun Li, who you actually turned me on to.
Right, yeah. Great writer. People often ask me these questions, and I feel stumped by them. I feel like I'm on, 20 questions.
Well, let me ask you. You're in Iowa, and people will say, what do you think about, what's going on between the United States and China in the arms race?
Exactly.
These. But novelists are, and have been traditionally people of polymath wisdom and knowledge.
Well, I think because of the areas we delve into in research and needing to know influences historically and how they manifest in present times. And so I am asked these questions. And, of course, I do have opinions, but I always have to couch them with the explanation that I'm one person and I'm certainly not an expert.
Chris, I remember once you telling me that when you went to, I think it was Iowa again, you went to start talking to you like, you likey the state. Or, they assume because you're Chinese that you must be from China. Because there's so few Chinese Americans.
That must have been a long, long time ago. I don't think it was Iowa. It was what was going on during the time of the Detroit, the economic downturn, one of them. Years ago in the automotive industry, and Japan was buying up everything, and people looking at me and talking to me in pidgin, asking me if I had come from Japan to buy up another company.
Here's Cecile. Welcome, Cecile. You're on the air with us.
Thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned Kathy Goldmark, who was a big love of mine as well. And I was curious, two things. I know that you were kind enough to take her to China when she was very ill, but and I wondered what you wanted to show her in China. That's one question. And the other question was, did you look at Susan Griffin's book on courtesans at all? Two questions.
Both,
thank you for mentioning Kathy Goldmark.
Oh, good yes. questions. Thank you for them, Cecilia.
No, the second one, I have not been able to see Susan Griffin's novel, but I certainly will now take the opportunity to read it. Kathy had said when she was first diagnosed with breast cancer, one of the things she was afraid of was not being able to travel to many of the places she had hoped to go to, one of them being China. And I said, we can still travel, you know, and there's no reason why you can't travel now. We made a plan, actually, for her to join me on my birthday in Raja Ampat, which is in Papua New Guinea, in the middle of nowhere, and to go snorkeling, live on these cottages in a remote island with 25 friends. And I was so afraid that because of her physical condition and difficulty in walking, she would not make that. But instead, she made it to Shanghai, and we were able to see Shanghai. She created another band there, impromptu band, did a musical gig, and on the island put together a gig with the staff there that sang to me on my birthday. It was phenomenal. So, and a month later she died. But it was just, she was there even to the end, spreading music and joy and love.
And it's true, I believe, that her last word was Rosebud. I mean, right to the end, the comedian.
Yeah, she was an amazing woman.
Let me thank you, Cecile, for the call. And let's bring Jennifer on. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you. Join us, please.
Oh, thanks. I just wanted to say a quick comment. I absolutely adore every book that Amy Tan has written and eagerly look forward to each book like a kid in a candy store. And I just wanted to tell her that I think it is a testament to your incredible creativity and talent as a writer that as a 51-year-old white woman, I get so immersed in your characters that there have been times that I've read your books and walked by a mirror and was shocked to not see a young Chinese girl from a different era. I just want to say, love your books. Keep on writing them. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call and appreciate hearing from you. Of course, going all the way back to the Joy Luck Club, you seem to really hit a universal chord with that.
I was surprised. That certainly was unexpected. And I'm also very grateful that after these years of not producing anything for 8 years, that except for the French, you know, our Parisian singers launch at Yoshi's, that people still remember and buy my books on the basis of past books.
Well, when was the opera, the Bonesetters opera?
It was 2008. That also took up a huge amount of time, fundraising, writing the libretto, doing PR for that. And I built a house from the ground up, which
that's
is
right.
like, that is like, believe me, that's like writing two novels.
I remember visiting Frances Mays in Tuscany, and Ed, her significant other, said, I built a house. This is instead of writing the epic poem that I'm trying to write. Really, there's a lot of truth to that. We're talking to Amy Tan, and again, her new novel is The Valley of Amazement. And that last listener mentioned creativity. We go back to, I'm not going to tell this story, Esalen, but we go back
to
a creativity conference at Esalen, and suddenly somebody sent me a link, I didn't get to see it, about you giving a TED Talk on creativity. What was that?
They gave me this topic, where does creativity hide? And, you know, who knows? How do you define imagination or creativity? And I made an attempt to look at my own past and to look at what might have spurred creativity and the need to examine and find meaning and explanation, understanding of what had gone on in my life. Since then, I've had another notion about creativity, which has to do with metaphors and imagery and how you take past experiences and associate them very quickly with some image that encapsulates what you're feeling and seeing and thinking, you know, all the sensorial qualities of an experience.
Here's a listener who tweets, thanks to Amy Tan for supporting Marcus Books. Can she tell us how African-American studies and literature help shape her and other Asian-American works?
When I was an English major, actually, all the writers that we read, all the authors, the works, were white American or English males, and except for Virginia Woolf, And one year, I took a class in the summer. It was called Black Literature. And you literally had to get these segregated courses, you know, to read something else. And it was such an eye-opener, a different perspective that really resonated with me, you know, that had nothing to do with a white male culture that I would never be able to identify with.
You also studied linguistics way back
when. Yeah. I was fascinated with words, with sentences and perceptions that they created. And it was more wordplay than anything. I had no idea what I would do with it in the future. But that, I think, was also training for me to become a writer, you know, this play with language.
You want to hear a critical email?
Sure.
are you open to that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Well, this is a listener who writes, "Sex sells. There's a lot to like about Tan's first book, but I've always been puzzled by the rapturous reception to Amy Tan's books and her enthronement as white Americans must-read Chinese-American author. My skepticism isn't so much about Tan, but about the somewhat limited imagination of white readers and U.S. publishers when it comes to Chinese-American women writers. Maxine Hong Kingston is by far a more ambitious, thoughtful, though less commercial writer who has spent many decades now coaching U.S. military veterans to write. Of course, Kingston doesn't endlessly market herself and writes about issues considerably more challenging than courtesans and clothing choices. Her work has always struck me as more authentically American and more authentically Chinese. Gish Jen's work is also stronger than Tan's, but is given far less attention. Heaven forbid we allow ourselves to imagine Chinese-American women writers to fall into categories that so boldly challenge the status quo."
I've, you know, I over the years, I've received comments similar to that. In which people believe.
But also comments saying you're much better than those writers, too.
I don't take offense to that. We all look for something in our writers, not just in literature that we read, but in looking at what those writers should do for society, that they serve a purpose when they have the limelight, that they must, you know, certainly be engaged and have that responsibility. I happen to feel that literature is literature. It's an art, and that is not supposed to necessarily create some kind of role model. Those writers may, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, be better than me. The focus on the me as a writer, you know, I can't explain it. It is, it causes resentment, as this, you know, reader has expressed. But I write.
Does the name Frank Chin bring back any memories?
Yes. Well, I have to write what is personally important to me. And as I said, this was based on, every novel is based on something in my family, something I have to explore. So the sex, to her, may be gratuitous, and it may be that,
I don't know if it's a her or a he.
Or he. I'm sorry. Gratuitous. No, that it may be that this is something that strikes her as too commercial. But I write based on personal.
Well, your last novel, Saving Fish from Drowning, was a very political book. I mean, it was all about Burma, Myanmar, and, you know, you stepped out of your usual.
Yeah. Well, it was my obsession with, you know, our intentions and what we do and can't do and how we feel about it. Responsibility for people who are in true trouble and pain and facing death. What can we do about it? And so I wanted to examine that more in depth. And how could we ever imagine what is needed to get Burma out of this very repressive state? I could not have imagined the answer that would lead to the release of Aung San Suu Kyi. Elections, you know, that are happening that put her back in with a voice.
And just for listeners who, again, may think I'm being oblique, Frank Chin was actually a very talented writer, both playwright and fiction writer, who excoriated Amy Tan and Maxine Hong Kingston and had, I think, a great deal of anger. Maybe one could have surmised jealousy as well, but was certainly not soft-spoken about that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's this question in a lot of people's mind is what is authentic? And I think it's a mistaken notion that there's only one voice that is authentic and represent all of Chinese culture. And, you know, then that the next question is which one is more valuable? And I think that's a very individual choice.
Especially Chinese-American culture, because it's so vast and so vastly different, you know, that to homogenize it is to mistake what it really is.
I had people who excoriated me or, you know, lambasted me for having mothers who spoke in broken English and or who were concubines. And I had to say, well, you know, my mother spoke in broken English and I'm not going to apologize for the fact that she did that. And she was very wise in how she talked, even in her broken English. But that perception was mine when I was a child, that she had, you know, was a terrible stereotype.
Again, you can join us with Amy Tan, email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us, 866-733-6786, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Joseph from Vallejo. Joseph, join us. Hi.
Yes, hello. Amy Tan, I am a big fan of yours, and I've read your book, all throughout high school. But I did want to go back to your very, very first book film, The Joy Luck Club. If you were to shoot the movie again today, would you change the cast? And if you did, and if you would you change the characters?
Boy, I've never been asked that. No, I loved the cast. You know, I was very involved with that movie. I was co-producer and co-screenwriter and also involved in casting. I didn't tell anybody because I had family or friends, parents who were trying out for those roles, and I didn't want them to get angry at me. But I actually was involved with the casting. So can't think of anybody else I would have wanted to have.
Thank you, Joseph, for the call. Another mutual friend of ours has been with you ever since the Joy Luck Club, and that's Molly Giles. What role is she playing now in your novelist's career?
Molly has been my first reader, the one who looks at those horrible pages and gives me that first reader feedback. She was the one, actually, who said after a few chapters, you know, this takes place in a courtesan house, and you are going to have to finally write a sex scene. And, you know, I put on the brakes, the little skids on the heels of my shoes, and I had to finally say, yes, maybe you're right, that they weren't playing ping pong in those houses. I chose to do it not simply because, oh, courtesan house sex, but as so much a part of the negotiation of what was going on between those men and women, and also this difference between commerce and intimacy.
The old platitude is the oldest profession and all of that, but the truth of the matter is, culturally, brothels, houses of prostitution, courtesan houses, whatever, are different, aren't they?
They are more like geisha houses. They were young girls who
From judging from the pictures, very young.
Yeah. Very young, yeah. Starting at the age of 14, 15, even younger than that. And I will have to say, you know, not only has it been the oldest profession, it has been the oldest crime, in one of the oldest crimes in nature, sex trafficking. These were girls who were often kidnapped, or they came into the profession because their mothers had been courtesans. But in doing this book, I was looking at the continuum of sex, the sex trade in Shanghai during that time and now. And it went from first-class courtesan house, where the women were courted and got to choose among their suitors who would have their intimate favors. Second-class courtesans, which, you know, the courting period was shorter, to flower opium houses or private homes, streetwalkers, down to the sheds where often, you know, drug-addicted little girls were lying on their backs taking 20 tricks a day or more. And today, you know, we think this is only a problem in Asia. There are something like 300,000 young people under the age of 18 who are at risk for sex trafficking. And that has very much to do that we have 450,000 young people who are runaways.
Oh, it's global.
We've done programs on it, and the amount of money is staggering.
It's easier than trying to get drugs in. You know, this is my niece, this is my child, and so forth. It's done all the time under the guise of.
Yeah.
Here's a Facebook comment from Michelle who says, "What does Ms. Tan think of the writing of Linda C?"
Oh, Lisa C.
I think she means Lisa C.
Oh, yeah. Lisa C.
She's a close friend of yours, isn't she?
She is. In fact, Lisa and I went on to China on one of our research trips. We went together. She went for, I can't remember whether it was Shanghai Girls or another one. And then I went for the Valley of Amazement. We stayed at that very old house, the 400-year-old house. And I had thought we should stay there for 2 weeks. Lisa thought it should be shorter, and her wisdom prevailed, thank God.
Now, Lisa C. has also been on Forum and has had a great deal of success as a writer. There's this notion, though, that Chinese culture somehow is perhaps more, well, I'm trying to think of the right word here, but is more oppressive in some ways where women's sexuality is concerned because of bound feet, because of, you know, wife number one and wife number two and all those ancient associations with Chinese culture.
Right. It was...
That it's more misogynistic somehow.
Right. You know, I think in American culture, they just call them mistresses and have them off to the side. But they had an official status in China. Concubines were far lower than those first wives and had a sexuality, a taint associated with them, not unlike courtesans. My grandmother, aside from the possibility of having been a courtesan, was a concubine in her first marriage and in her second. We thought she was the first wife to a scholar for her first one. I found out during the research, doing the research for this novel, that she had, in fact, been the second. Women did not have the right to divorce, as was the case with my mother. She could not escape her abusive husband. She tried. She ran away. She was placed in jail. And that is one thing that my mother thought was good, is that the Communist Party enabled women to divorce. Not that it was easy, but at least they had, the possible ability to initiate the divorce.
So listener says, the chapter called Etiquette is an amazing monologue from Magic Gourd introducing Violet and 21st century readers of all ethnicities to the rules of the courtesan world. Did you consider any other devices which could have done the job?
I could have had very long chapters in which Violet is learning these through experience. And I thought to save her a lot of pain, Magic Gourd should just tell her what the lay of the land was and just, so to speak, she should give her wisdom, and for very practical reasons, so that she would get off to a start that would enable her and Magic Gourd to extract the most amount of money and to set her value early on as very high.
Here's Jay. Jay, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just want Amy, I was at the opening night of Bonesetter's Daughter at the opera, and it was just one of the best experiences I'd ever had at the opera. And was wondering if that music will ever be available, or a DVD will ever be available, that we could enjoy it again.
Oh, I wish. You know, these what happens at an opera really has, there are so many contracts that are involved, and they have to do with sign-offs with the musicians and the unions and so many things, that it would take a vast amount of money to have that produced. And I can't even remember what it would be just to get a sample available to people. Right now, it's not available even to if I wanted to give one to Michael, I couldn't. I could not give it to him. So who knows what would happen. It's very difficult to mount a new opera. All those costs have to be borne in mind. Who gets the money for that? So
I'm sorry, Jay, you had something else?
Well, just that it was really a moving performance, and the interplay between Asian and European opera and everything. It was just really amazing.
Thank you for that call. Why did you decide to make Violet, the daughter of Lulu, the two major protagonists, part American?
I wanted to have some sort of shift in circumstance. It was so dramatic. And I, in part because I felt that there were huge major shifts in my mother's life. When she went from Shanghai to America, suddenly she was not this beautiful socialite in Shanghai. She was on different territory. She was invisible. She didn't speak English that well. Her circumstances were so changed, her life upturned. And so in the same way, Violet lives this very privileged life as an American. She starts off, I knew exactly who I was. I was an American. And the rest of the chapter shows that she was not so sure. And indeed, she becomes the other side and is cast into a world where she has to rethink who she is and make her way and consider who she is and how she thinks of herself.
And again, at the risk of sounding like I'm doing a little lay psychoanalysis, it's fascinating to me how, I mean, you're talking about your own half-sisters in China. We find out about a brother in America.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a reversal in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. It's those surprises, and they're wondering, you know, did Mother love Amy best? And the same way Violet wonders, did Mother love the son best? The competitiveness that we have as children as well for a parent's love.
This is also, I think, easily described as a novel about family secrets, and I'm wondering to what extent you, in writing the novel, unearth these. I mean, unlike, I suppose, a lot of novelists who just chart everything and plot everything and have graphs and so forth, I get the sense that this is coming to you as you're moving along.
It happens organically, and when this one happened, I then had to abandon the other novel and just go with this because I was so obsessed with it. I thought I was done with all the secrets. You know, I unearthed and numbered them over the years, and I thought, well, there's nothing else. And then this, boom, this comes. And since then, I've found others. And I'm, you know, just wondering what I should do with those you know, how they are forming what I've been thinking about, and especially with the next novel.
Your imagination and your mojo both active.
Oh, yes. I mean, especially when they turn my understanding around of many things. My mother, you know, finding out these other secrets. And this one, here's one that's not even that dramatic. Finding out she never got divorced from the first husband.
And two countervailing people wanted to weigh in on that email, that critical email, and just give you a sense. Thank you, Amy Tan, for giving us a rare look into Chinese domestic life through your wonderful books. Another writer, Eugene, says, writing's not a competition. It's far too complex to make comparisons, like comparing stars and suns and moons, which is better. Thank you, Amy Tan. Always delight to have you.
Thank you.
Again, she'll be at City Arts and Lectures tonight at 7:30, and the book is The Valley of Amazement. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.